You're listening to Body Banter, a podcast where we have conversations about the human body in all its forms and from as many perspectives we can find.
We are your hosts, Chagoye Dile
and Claudia Krebs.
And we are professors of anatomy in the Faculty of Medicine at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada.
Anatomy is for everybody and everybody, and we're here to get the body banter going.
We hope you enjoy this episode.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Body Banter. My name is Claudia Krebs, and I'm joining you from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations, also known as Vancouver, Canada. And it is my absolute pleasure to welcome a friend of mine to the podcast, Adam Taylor. Hi, Adam. How are you?
Hey, Claudia. I'm really good. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm so excited by this opportunity and looking forward to chat.
Well, why don't you introduce yourself to our audience? Like, what do you do in your day job?
So I'm a professor of anatomy at a university in the northwest of England called Lancaster. It's a small city on the northwest coast, about 40 miles north of the big cities of Liverpool and Manchester, which I'm guessing a lot of people will have heard of in relation to their soccer teams, if nothing else. My day job, as the name suggests, I'm involved in primarily teaching anatomy to our medical students, but also our elements to our biomedical students, a little bit of kind of science communication to our sports and exercise science students, and to some extent our medical students too. So it's all kind of things anatomical, which you know, you do it also in your day job, and I'm sure many of the listeners do. But also I've got a real passion around public engagement, schools engagement, whether that's primary schools here for kids up to the age of 11, and then going beyond that to high school kids between the ages of 11 and 18, and also to the general public. Basically anybody that'll listen to me talk about anatomy, I'm happy to pitch to them. So yeah, anatomy education to those that sign up through university, but also a lot of outreach and engagement to give opportunities and knowledge to those people who are less fortunate, maybe haven't had the opportunity to be exposed to it in schools, university courses, or just life in general.
Yeah, you sound very busy. And we know that there's a huge need to communicate this because you're a little bit of a BuzzFeed celebrity in your little quizzical that you put there to research what people know about the human body. And full disclosure, I totally did your quiz. I aced it. I'll be honest. I did it. I did okay. Because, you know, insomniac nights, what do? You do little quizzes on BuzzFeed, right? Like that's what you do. But not everybody aced the test. Tell us about your research there.
So I have no doubt. I obviously don't know who you were and which one of our 80,000 participants you were, but I'm sure you were in the top few percent, along with many of the other anatomists that we call colleagues and friends that were kind enough to complete the survey. It's as you say, the kind of anatomy. I look at it as we're really privileged in the jobs that we do as anatomists. We get to see things that most other, you know, people don't get to see. We're exposed to a lot of things through the kind of body donation and gifting programs that many medical schools have. And we're able to use those gifts to teach the next generation of healthcare professionals. Many people have an interest in anatomy. And I always say that it's sometimes not obvious because, you know, we all are healthy, we're young and healthy, we're developing, hopefully normally. But then eventually, even if you're not interested in anatomy from the outset, you will eventually develop an interest because we know that one of the things that we can't escape in life is aging, right? Things kind of move from where they're supposed to be, start falling off, start hurting, all of those things. And so your attention kind of turns to anatomy in terms of, well, why is this happening? You know, why have I got this lump here? Why is this swelling here? Or worse than that. And so people begin to kind of look for anatomy as a symptom of something that may be wrong. And quite often their knowledge isn't at a level that that helps them make a decision or understand what's going on. And they seek medical help quite rightly through their practitioner. But there is evidence, not of my research, but from others that's published out there, suggesting that quite often they don't fully understand what it is they're being told. And so through my kind of interest in public engagement and anatomy teaching, it got me thinking about, well, what do the public really know about anatomy? Do they know kind of the difference between pointing to their elbow and their ear, which is vastly simplifying the issue, but even structures such as the heart, which we all have this fantastic piece of scientific kit that is our human body, but do we really know kind of what lies beneath the skin? And so we did some preliminary work in 2017 through an outreach program, through an outreach activity that was run by my institution, where they take scientists into the city center and get them to showcase the things that they do. My institution is based about 3 miles outside the city, so we're not a campus university within a big city. And quite often, people kind of look at us and go, "Oh, you know, the students. We teach the students. They come in, they do their thing, and then they disappear. What do the academics do?" And so, this was really important to kind of get us into the city and showcase all of the wonderful teaching and research activities that go on, give people the opportunity to learn, but also the opportunity to see what research is being done. And so, as part of that, we came up with almost a quiz, like you said. You've done this the latter version, but this spring, this started out of basically giving people the outline of a human body and a list of structures, and saying, you know, it's almost like pin the tail on the donkey. Where is the heart? Where is the lungs? Where's the liver? And that research, it was a very small scale study. We only got 66 participants. But it became quite apparent that as an anatomist and all the things that we take for granted that people understand, there was quite a diverse knowledge of anatomy in terms of what people know. The paper was published in Anatomical Sciences Education in 2017, and if people want to go and read it, please do so. But some of the headlines that came out of it were basically that anything in the abdomen was pretty poorly answered, both by people who identified as male and equally by people who identified as female. But I think one of the things that was most surprising to us, that only about two out of every three people were able to correctly locate the position of the heart, which is quite shocking in some ways, given that particularly in the Western world, one in three people will die from heart-related disease. One in three will be from cancer, and the other three will be other one in three will be for everything else that doesn't fall into cancer or heart-related disease. And we know that there's a concept called health literacy, whereby if people understand their body and they understand the health information that's being conveyed to them by their professionals, they are able to make better, more informed choices and seek the right kind of input and treatment earlier. And obviously, by doing that, the likelihood of survival and outcomes are better, which is, you know, what we all strive for to spend as long as possible on this planet doing the things that we enjoy. And so that small scale study identified that there was quite a deficit in knowledge. The one thing I will say in from that original study that came out was quite strong was musculoskeletal knowledge. So things like biceps, triceps, quadriceps, hamstrings, those muscle groups and individual muscles were answered pretty well, which suggests, you know, the kind of the key concepts of musculoskeletal activity, maybe going to the gym, cycling, you know, the basics like that seem to be well understood more widely. But then the kind of core things that keep us alive, the liver, the heart, some of the major viscera, are much less poorly understood. And so this study, when we published it, the reviewers quite rightly said, well, you know, it's very Lancaster-centric. It's quite a small-scale study. It's really interesting. But, you know, what can you do next? What's next? And so that got us thinking, well, how do we take this to the next level? And if we're going to go to the next level, let's just go full nuclear scale and see how far we can push it. So we were lucky enough to team up with an entity called the Zooniverse, who are citizen science pioneers. I'm sure many of your listeners are either familiar with it or citizen scientists through their website. And they take particularly large data sets and scientific studies and put them on their platform for citizen scientists to contribute to science. And they often rely on the almost the expertise or the kind of amateur interests of those citizen scientists to contribute to projects around wildlife or astronomy. And ours was the first project that, as far as I'm aware, that went to them with the interest of not using their expertise to help with data analysis, but actually assessing what they know in terms of a particular science, in this instance, anatomy. And so we put that online to see what happened. And as you know, as a scientist, as a researcher, you go through the process of planning out studies with the best way in the world, thinking, I know how this is going to go. And we got our ethical approval in place. We went to the Research Ethics Committee and said, can we get 20,000 participant responses for this? And we broadened out the organs and structures that we were asking for. So initially we had, the kind of key organs and viscera, spleen, gallbladder, adrenals, pancreas, liver, kidneys, appendix, heart, all the things that pop up that more often than not go wrong at some point. We've all known people have had their appendix out or they've torn a hamstring and those kind of things. But we expanded a little bit. We added some genitalia. So we put things like the uterus, the ovaries on. We added the prostate. Obviously, prostate is the biggest cancer killer of men in particularly in the Western world, but in the world more broadly. And a couple of other structures, thinking about, from a public health perspective, do people understand? Do people know where these are? Because if you don't know where they are and you begin to get signs and symptoms, you may not follow up appropriately. So we expanded this study. We went to the ethics committee and said, we'd like to get 20,000 participant responses. And we went through the process and we went through the beta test. We set it live. And within the space of a few days, I found myself having to go back to the research ethics committee saying, we've been inundated with responses. We're getting close to the 20,000 mark. And the shows no sign of letting up. Can we increase this? Can we go for 50 or 100,000? And they said, yeah, absolutely. We'd be happy for you to do that. So we went up to 100,000 and it was picked up, as you referenced earlier on, by BuzzFeed, by some of the popular newspapers over here in the UK saying, we want to carry a piece on this. And interestingly, these things do, not only were they wanting to carry a piece, they also wanted the answer sheet so that they could put it online so that people can compare how they do, and then having to have a discussion with the editor saying, sorry, you can't do that because that's going to skew our data and destroy our study and those kind of things. So it was quite a challenge to get through that. But the kind of response that we got was just phenomenal. I never in my wildest dreams envisaged that would happen so rapidly and so, such an overwhelming response to something that span out of a very small scale study in the northwest of England. And so by the time we closed it, we'd peaked at just over 81,000 responses. And so that was in 2019. Obviously, a lot of things happened around the world since then, and we're just again beginning to get back into the data and finish beginning to write that up and analyze it. I obviously saw yourself in a conference earlier in the year where I presented some of this, and some of the results echo what we see in the little small scale Lancaster study, in that there is a really varied response to what people know about their body, particularly again around the abdominal viscera. The heart, again, shocked us. 60% of people can only correctly locate the heart. And so this is really exciting for us because it begins to highlight the challenge that we have as educators, particularly with our kind of engagement and outreach hats on, in terms of how do we fix this problem? Because when we go into schools, particularly the young kids, when we do outreach with them, they're really interested in the body. If I vaguely remember the days when I was at school, I'm getting to that age now where it's becoming a bit of a blur. But when I was at school, everybody wanted to be the tallest, the fastest, the strongest, all of these kind of metrics. And they're so enthusiastic about their body and their learning. And then it kind of seems to drop off when we looked at the data. That age kind of peaks around about 18 to mid-20s, and then the knowledge level disappears. And one of the questions is, why is that? And so, when we get into schools, how do we get this information to stay with people so that they can use it to their advantage in the longer term? And so there's a lot of really interesting data that we're beginning to pull out of this in this larger scale study.
Cool that you've got this huge data set now, right? Like there's such a wealth of information.
Yes.
As you were talking, I was thinking, we take our knowledge so much for granted, like as experts on the human body, we obviously walk around our lives kind of always knowing where our liver is, right? Like, yep. It's not that we say good morning to it every day, but, you know, we kind of know where it is. It's ingrained in us. And so it becomes hard to imagine people having no clue on what is inside of their body cavity. And I found that maybe the most shocking thing about your research is that all the knowledge that we take for granted is actually absent in many people. And it's interesting because when you look at illustrations like from the Middle Ages before we had reinstated body dissection and all of that for a real exploration of the anatomy, there would be a lot of mythology around sort of the inner workings of the body, you know, like with things moving around and, you know, different vapors and humors and whatever, making up the machinery of the human body. And with this loss of knowledge in people who are not experts, where do you see that going in terms of how people perceive their own bodies? Because we all have this body. Like, as you said, we're all born with this terrific piece of scientific kit. I love that formulation that you use there, right? We all have it. And yet, by and large, we show very little interest in it, maybe except for like our muscles, because it's something that is visible and we can show off and it shows our status. I guess, you know, having a cool biceps has more status than knowing where your liver is. I don't know.
That's a really good question, because those, like you say, the absence of knowledge is astounding to those of us that kind of consider it just the core basics. You know, we don't say good morning to our liver, but we know that that's where it is. And if there's pain there, then we need to get it looked at and those kind of things. And that absence of knowledge is, you know, as I was alluding to earlier, the school kids, the really young school kids are so interested in it. And then obviously, as your body grows and develops, as you age, you know, going through puberty and your teenage and formative years, and then to some extent, you know, you kind of go through that journey in life where you meet your partner or partners and you explore their bodies and those kind of things. So we kind of, you know, we have this exposure to our own body and other people's body. And then we have children. And so we have to kind of know a little bit about what's going on with them. You know, children, they're sick and you have to clean up after them and all those kind of things. But it's not that level of knowledge of those kind of individual structures just seems to disappear. And the question is why. It's probably displaced by, you know, knowing where your car keys are and those kind of things. But it's, you know, it has a value in that knowledge. And how do we kind of reignite the passion for understanding those things that we often consider as basic anatomical knowledge. One thing I will say about that kind of basic understanding, and I don't want to open an argument across the biological sex divide, is that in the data analysis that we've done on the preliminary study and on the larger scale study, those women are much better at identifying the abdominal, you know, the kind of thoracic and abdominal viscera, the locations of them. And I wonder if there's an element around that because of the menstrual cycle, for example, and having a kind of underpinning knowledge of what goes on with their bodies and looking at it from that perspective. There's a kind of, they have that exposure to that kind of underlying knowledge, knowing that there are things in their pelvis and then there are things in their abdomen and kind of having a rough guess. But there was an interesting paper I was reading a few weeks ago around pelvic organ prolapse and a study similar to mine, but it was conducted in a number of hospitals here in the UK by some researchers, particularly with an interest in gynecology and obstetrics. And I was astounded to read that they'd asked basic things again around the location of the uterus, ovaries, but also something as simple as how many holes are there in a woman's external perineum, you know, how many holes are there down there? And some women were unaware that they had three holes down there, you know, a rectal opening, a vagina and a urethra. And again, that kind of astounding absence of knowledge is something that we, you know, we should be doing better to educate people, particularly around women's health. So our research doesn't go into that level of detail. We have asked some questions around the level of knowledge of the location of the ovaries and the uterus in our most recent study, and around the prostate, again with a kind of an interest in understanding, you know, do men understand where the prostate is? Do women understand where the uterus and the ovaries are? Both with a view to health, but also from a keeping the human species alive, you know, that kind of need to potentially have children and those kind of things, you know, all of that health is kind of intertwined together. And without some of those structures, we cannot produce the next level of humans. So that's, you know, that's really interesting. So there are other people looking at areas of this with a kind of clinical focus. You know, pelvic organ prolapse study is a really interesting one, and I was astounded by some of our findings, but that paper in particular to me really opened my eyes to what that absence of knowledge is, particularly in people who are seeking help for a specific clinical or, you know, pathological reason. And the work we're doing is novel in some ways, particularly because of the size of it. But the people have done this previously and looked at studies asking patients who are seeking treatment for liver-related conditions and lung-related conditions. And again, many of them don't know the location of the organs that they're being treated for. And again, you know, that has implications for understanding management of their kind of rehab or prehabilitation and all those things. So we've got a real challenge in trying to get this information to people in a way that's accessible, in a way that's relatable and relevant. And then there's the flip side of, we as anatomists can't do this on our own. We as scientists can't do this on our own. You know, the government, most governments have that kind of public health messaging and those kind of things. And we, you know, how can we feed into that? How can we be part of that?
Yeah, I think it's really important to partner with, you know, outlets that have this reach. It's really interesting. I mean, if you say people don't know where the heart or where the lungs are, I mean, breathing and heartbeat is something that is, you know, core to the human experience, of course, right? We do it all the time. It's one of those machinations that we're quite aware of, right? That they're happening, and that folks don't know where their sex organs are, their genitalia. Sex is a huge part of life as well. And sure. That whole area of anatomy is, I think, still clouded with a lot of shame and taboo and, depending on the age group, giggles and sort of being uncomfortable with it. And so how do you think your work might help especially young kids or teenagers be more comfortable with their body, more accepting of their bodies, more aware, more knowledgeable? You said it's hard to get that information out, but I know you're doing it. So what's your secret?
As I said at the start, I'll talk to anybody that'll listen. You know, that's the thing. And it is really difficult. Because there are so many barriers to break down when you think, you know, wherever you stand on the last 3 years and COVID, you know, there are people that have had their lives turned upside down, long COVID, deaths of family members. And we as scientists, we've always struggled to get that information out there. I think, you know, I think you find very few scientists who would argue with that fact in terms of trying to get scientific information out there. And we can't do it on our own. We, as you say, we have to partner with the public health scientists, the doctors, the various branches of the government that are responsible for these kind of things, because we really have, we've been set back masses, you know, huge amounts in the last 3 years, because there's been so much turmoil and kind of up, you know, difficulty in terms of communicating science. You know, very few people are actually trained in being able to communicate science and get that messaging out there. It's a really hard skill. And you can, you know, and I'm not saying that I can do that. I will listen to anybody I will talk to anybody that will listen. But there are always going to be people in hard to reach populations, hard to reach areas. And there are always going to be people that, you know, don't want to be reached. So we've got to do the best for those people who want to listen and have the time and the need to kind of know. And thankfully, anatomy is one of those, as I said earlier, one of those kind of science areas where everybody has their own toolkit. They have their own specimen. They have their own bit of anatomy, and it changes over time. Going back to what you were saying about, you know, particularly around teenagers and children developing, you know, we as anatomists, we have seen it all, and we would be the first to admit that everybody is different, and every bit of everybody's body is completely different, and that's okay. You know, that is absolutely fine. There is no kind of set standards. There's no set outlook to what we see, and I think certainly looking at the generation that are growing up today versus when I was growing up, they're exposed to very different things. They're exposed to the kind of internet of it should be these chiseled torsos and sun bronzed skin and all these kind of things, and anatomy. Everybody's anatomy is different. You know, that is one, what you see on the internet is one person's take on what perfection should or, you know, is, and everybody's anatomy is different. And that is a really hard concept to break and get out there because of that, as you say, that taboo around, particularly around genitalia, around sex and you know, even being naked in your own home, you know, some people find that a very uncomfortable concept. And so I think trying to get out there and talk to people and make them understand that actually everybody is different. You know, if you look up and down the high street, the bits of you know, or look around your college or your school, the bits of people's anatomy that you see, you know, their hands, their face, it's all different, and it's the same under the bits that you can't see, and that's okay. There is no gold standard or set standard to what we should look like. And I think that is something that we don't put out there often enough. We don't say enough about that it is different, and it's okay to be different. You know, and I'm not an expert on that area, but that's certainly what we're trying to say with anatomy. We have these things that are in certain positions, but they're all different. And that's okay. You know, the understanding that your heart is in your chest and it beats, that's what we want to take away from it. It doesn't matter how big your heart is or how small your heart is. It keeps you alive, and that's all we care about. So it is, it's really difficult. And obviously there are some areas of the world where the challenge is even bigger. So there are education is a massive part of this in terms of getting into schools and trying to help them understand the body. And we're quite lucky in the UK, and I can't speak for Canada. Sorry, I don't know how things are in Canada, but certainly in the UK, there's a lot of scope for this kind of anatomical learning and anatomical outreach. It's built into our national curriculum at school. But then when you look at you know, other countries like the United States, a massive population, but no national curriculum around many things. It's on a state level, particularly thinking about anatomical learning and this kind of physical health and sexual education. Again, it's at state level, and the requirements differ from state to state. And so how do we get into those hard to reach populations and try and help them? And we're not, you know, all we're trying to do is make them aware of their bodies and make them aware that anatomy is what it is. And you learn about it because at the end of the day, your anatomy changes. It changes with age, but it also changes with pathology and trying to kind of reach out to some of those hard to reach populations is going to be a challenge, you know, and I'm saying that in relation to, colleagues who work in the United States and do, you know, the same kind of thing that I do in their local communities. It is a real challenge. And, you know, we're under no illusion that on our own, individually or as a community of educators, we can't do this on our own. It's going to be a real kind of slog. And I'm sure we will not break the back of it in my lifetime or yours, I'm afraid.
Oh, dear. Well, but I think it is. There is hope, right? Because we've Absolutely. Got so many more media to reach folks. I think it's becoming more and more apparent that we need more diversity in anatomy representations, because that will reach more people. If we always show the white CrossFit man as the anatomical standard, there's a lot of, like, the majority of the world population is going to be like, that's obviously not me, and they disengage.
Absolutely.
What is the most surprising thing that you found in your huge data set so far as you're combing through the data? Like the one thing where you're like, wow, I wasn't expecting that.
So, I'm gonna make myself into a moving target for a number of people. There's a couple of things, and so I'll give you a quick summary of what we did in that data set, and then tell you some of the surprising things if there's time and that's okay. So we got just over 81,000 participant responses. We had to take a couple of them out because they weren't complete data sets. But from a global perspective, probably the most, so we asked people, there was 25 organs and structures to identify. We asked them for their age. We asked them for the gender that they identified as, or gave them the option to not disclose. And then we asked them for their highest educational qualification, if they worked in healthcare, if so, which branch, and gave them a drop-down option, you know, were you an educator, you were a medic, a dentist, et cetera, and had they been to visit a healthcare professional in the last week, and finally their geographical location. And one of the most surprising things in terms of the organs and structures that was poorly identified, again, was the heart. Just, I thought that was kind of a basic starter for 10. Everybody can point to it. But again, only two-thirds of people were able to correctly identify the location. In terms of the demographic data, there's no statistical difference between what those people identify as male know and those that identify as female. There are some differences in amongst the organs and structures. And I think we need to do a little bit more coverage, so don't quote me on this, but one of the interesting things was those individuals who identified as female knew the location of the prostate better than those people that did identify as male, which got us scratching our heads a little bit. But we know that studies in the UK that have been done by various charities identified that 50% of men didn't know they had a prostate. And of the 50% that did, only 50% of them could find it basically and point to it where it is. So kind of that's an interesting finding, but it'll be surprising to some of your listeners. But to us, we know that the prostate in men and its location is also an issue. I think probably the most surprising thing in terms of findings was around whether people worked in healthcare and not working in healthcare. And we expected the healthcare, obviously anatomy is a huge part of healthcare training and education, and so we expected them to be significantly better than in terms of, you know, how many out of 25 did you get right. We expected them to be significantly better, and what was probably most surprising and possibly worrying was that they were not statistically significantly better. And so we need to do a little bit more digging into the data.
I'm very worried.
Yeah, well, that's one of our shortcomings in terms of healthcare. It was self-reported and it's a massive field. So you've got people from kind of postgraduate medics and dentists all the way down to, you know, are some of them working in healthcare as kind of healthcare assistants? And so, you know, we could have been slightly better at giving more, you know, more drop down options for that. But that's something that we're going to have to work our way through. But, you know, shout out to the physiotherapists who came out on top. You know, their anatomy knowledge was top ranking. So if you're listening and you're a physio, you can give yourself a good pat on the back. Very closely followed in second place by the educators that include ourselves, such as anatomists and other people that work in medical education. So, you know, there is some really and then closely followed by the medics. So, you know, there's some really reassuring stuff in there, but there is some quite surprising stuff around, you know, basic knowledge of things like the heart, the lungs, the liver. And so, you know, we need to begin to think about how we address this, how we come up with a plan. And there is it's a challenge for us as individuals, because we're all, as anatomists in particular, we're so burdened with teaching and teaching related admin. It's about finding time and resources, and we're beginning to see, you know, our associations and our societies and our professional bodies recognize that outreach and engagement is a massive massive kind of civic responsibility to them. And we're beginning to see support and recognition from those societies and those professional bodies to support that, both in terms of supporting us as individuals, but also making resources and toolkits available for those for the societies to enable people to train and, you know, and go out and do things and kind of communicate science to anybody that has the opportunity to listen and try and learn something. Because I think if you can get somebody to take one anatomical fact away from any kind of outreach or engagement that you do, that has a huge potential, you know, to save their life, to make them seek healthcare sooner, earlier, and maybe have a different outcome or intervention, earlier intervention that, you know, at the end of the day will enable them hopefully to spend a little bit longer on this planet doing the things that they love and enjoy.
I like that. That's a good way of really of looking at it, right? Like that.
Sure.
The more we know, the better off we are globally, right?
Absolutely.
And kind of reaching that goal. So you've been thinking a lot about, obviously, about the human body and where things are and what people know and what your civic responsibility is towards sort of imparting that knowledge. But do you have a favorite body part?
So I have a favorite body part, and then I'm gonna guess you're gonna flip to the other side and the least favorite part. So my favorite body part is a muscle. So my favorite body part is a single muscle, and it's the one that the anatomists always like to kind of showcase, and that's palmaris longus. So it's the tiny muscle.
I was going to say serratus anterior. Going to go for serratus anterior.
Okay,
longus. So tell me all about your passion for palmaris longus.
So I've got a couple of muscles, but this one's the one that pops out all the time because it's always, is it there? Is it not there? So I guess for listeners, if they want to have a go at trying to find their palmaris longus, see if they've got one. So I guess the important thing to say is not everybody has them. And I'm in the unique position that I've got one in one arm and it's absent in my other arm. So if you want to have a go and look and see if you've got one, you put your thumb and your ring fingers together and then you bend your wrist towards you. And if it's there, it'll pop up as it can be quite a slender kind of stringy tendon just coming across your wrist creases running towards your thumb. So I think you've got a nice one there, Gloria. You're demonstrating. Yeah, you've got them in both your bilateral palmaris longus. So I've only got one, and so I like that because it's a nice piece of anatomy that's under the skin that you can get people to demonstrate by putting their ring and thumbs together and bending forwards. And I like to do that with our students when we're teaching the musculoskeletal system because it highlights that there is some variation. So yeah, that's I'm guessing you've not had palmaris longus before.
Never. And I'm so happy that we have this beautiful muscle documented as a favorite body part now. That's really cool. And you know what? It speaks to your passion for public outreach and people understanding their own bodies, because as you say, it's something you can see on yourself. So that's, I mean, no surprises, I guess. Like once you know, it's like, yeah, that checks out. What about your least favorite body part?
I'm gonna go with a group of which we as adults should have 32, and that's teeth. And the reason for that is not because the British have a history of having appalling dentitions, as is the stereotype in things like The Simpsons and other popular TV shows, but it is my kryptonite. Teeth are my kryptonite. Dental pain, you know, I can't speak for certain types of pain that women have to go through in childbirth and things, but dental pain is my kryptonite. And when family members younger than me show me their wobbly teeth, that is my kryptonite. I hate teeth, and that is it. I don't know what it is about wobbly teeth and dental pain, but I hate them. I'm happy to teach them, just don't show me wobbly teeth and don't talk to me about toothache. So yeah, teeth are my least favorite part, but not because of the popular TV shows and horrible dentition that the British public are a stereotype for having.
That's interesting. We've never had teeth as a least favorite body part either. But I get it. I think trigeminal pain is some of the worst pain possible. And I sympathize with teeth. I mean, they're not my least favorite body part, but I can totally see where you're coming from.
Okay, yeah. That's good. That's good.
Well, thanks, Adam, so much for joining us today. Thank you for all your passion and knowledge around this. I think your project really has the potential to make huge changes globally in terms of public health and public education. Thank you for having done that work. And thank you for the passion you've so clearly poured into it. I look forward to reading the many papers that will come out of this data set so that we can understand things better, understand where the gaps are, and hopefully we can all come up with a plan to fill those gaps. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Claudia. No, thank you for having me on, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to kind of voice my passion on your platform. It's greatly appreciated.
Okay. Well, that wraps up another episode of Body Banter, and we look forward to being on the airwaves with our next guest in 2 weeks. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Body Banter.
We are Claudia
and Shegun.
And we look forward to having you join us for more conversations about the human body next time.